Hello, my name is Anissa Talaid-Moodley and I will be hosting today's episode of the podcast. Today I'll be talking to Sandy Saad-Smith, who is the curator of the Doris McCarthy Gallery at the University of Toronto. I'll be talking to her about her practice and about some of the recent exhibitions that she curated. Welcome, Sandy, to the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures podcast. So I will just introduce you briefly for our listeners. You're the curator of the gallery at UFT at the University of Toronto called the Doris McCarthy Art Gallery. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about who you are and, you know, about your work?
Sure. I actually studied here at U of T Scarborough. Being a child of immigrants, I entered school to study business. I entered a very practical field and line of work. And although I always loved art, I didn't see a clear path into a sustainable career. Mm-hmm. And I felt the guilt of wasting my parents' immigration on pursuing my dreams. Mm-hmm. So I actually initially came to school here to study the business program. And I entered into the business program and I was absolutely miserable. I had aimed to become an accountant and I took one elective and it was art history and I absolutely loved it and ended up mustering up the courage to take a huge risk and switch majors. And I studied arts management and art history, and my very first work study placement, kind of a student work experience, was at the Doris McCarthy Gallery. Mm-hmm. Like 17 years ago. Oh,
yeah.
And it was incredible. I was so loved being immersed around art and loved learning about the way artists saw the world. And it was a space for me to explore my own identity too, to understand being an immigrant and connecting to my own story and unpacking all of the things that you kind of don't get to unpack when you're so tied up in figuring out your path. So I felt that it was an incredible privilege. So I continued my educational career and did my master's in curatorial studies and then worked in a bunch of different places. And one of the challenges I faced studying in academia was the theoretical and very inaccessible theories around contemporary art sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in my master's degree and feeling like I had to be convoluted in order to sound intelligent. And I felt that there was such a barrier between making theory and art and understanding art accessible and the writing and all of the weight that came around it. And I really struggled my first year in my master's degree, but I'm grateful for that experience because I think it helped build empathy in me, in that I learned to appreciate art that was accessible to people. And that's kind of the crux of my practice. And my mission as a curator is to make the gallery a space that is welcoming, a space for people to spend time, write exhibition texts that are understandable, but not dumbing down the work, but accessible. Mm-hmm. I curate for immigrants. I curate for students who've never seen art before. I curate for a diverse audience that has such a broad base of experiences and perspectives, but I try to always make it accessible. And that's one of my biggest personal missions in my curatorial practice.
Mm-hmm. And that comes across in your exhibitions and the exhibitions that you created.
Thank you.
So we'll come back to that important aspect of your work. But just to start with one of the recent exhibitions you curated is the exhibition on the work of Erika de Freitas, which is called
It's Because of the Shimmer,
yes.
The Verge, and the Yet.
It's a loaded title.
Yes.
Trying to remember it. But it's Because of the Shimmer, the Verge, and the Yet. So can you tell us a bit about the title?
Yes.
And also, you know, the exhibition itself.
So Erika, this was a long time coming. She also graduated from U of T Scarborough. Mm-hmm. She lives in Scarborough. And one of our missions is to celebrate local talent and artists who come from Scarborough. She's an incredibly talented artist who's widely recognized and exhibited across Canada and the US. And it was time for her to have a big homecoming show. And so we treated this show as kind of like a mid-career retrospective. So 20 years of practice, and we brought so many works into that exhibition. It was maximalist. It was packed every inch of wall space, had work on it. And so when we were thinking about the title, Erica, who's incredibly poetic in her writing and her titles and thought processes, all her titles are like sentences. Mm-hmm. She wanted the title, It's Because of the Shimmer, which is the magic. Mm-hmm. The verge is the process of anticipation, and the yet of what is to come. Mm-hmm. And so she felt that those three things encompassed her practice. Mm-hmm. And her practice is one that is really grounded in intuition and spiritualism, mm-hmm. and the magic of not knowing, and the magic of collaborating with artists who have passed. Mm-hmm. And so it is truly one of the most unique exhibitions I've ever curated, and kind of opened a gateway to allow visitors to embrace that side of the unknown, the intuition, mm-hmm. the unclear process.
Mm. And that also comes up in your most recent exhibition, as we'll talk about in a minute, the unknown and the anticipation. But go back to De Freitas. As you said, the room was packed, and there was such a variety of different things, like the videos, sculpture, painting, collage. And so what was it like to create such a wide range of different things?
It was hard. Erica has so much work. And looking at a like 20-year practice and trying to figure out which works we could show was a long process. And Erica and I had been talking about and working towards that show for over 2 years. And so it was a collaborative process, one that I just point blank asked, what do you think are the most important works in your practice? Arabie avant moi, devant moi, which is the one about Jean Duval, was her most pivotal work. She felt that that was the most important work in her practice so far. Mm-hmm. And then we had the newspaper works. That was a series of cutout newspapers that she had taken from the deaths, memorials, and births section in the Toronto Star. Mm-hmm. And that was a work that she did in her master's degree. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a starting point of her career. Then there were a number of works that included her mom as a collaborator. And her mom is such a prominent figure in her practice and in her work. So we selected a few works that showed her relationship with her mom. And then all of the other women that she collaborated mm-hmm. with, Gertrude Stein, mm-hmm. the writer, there are a number of pieces that unpack Erica's fascination and use of a medium to connect with Gertrude Stein mm-hmm. in the process of making a work. And we have the Virgin Mary, Erica having been brought up in a Catholic upbringing mm-hmm. and having this contentious relationship with her faith, but seeing mm-hmm. and recreating the image of the Black Madonna as a female mm-hmm. of not, you know, modesty, but one of power mm-hmm. and strength. And so she, in her process, she built this incredible archive of women that she had admired mm-hmm. and connected with throughout her practice, but also women who had been erased from history. And the exhibition design was created to look like a museum exhibition with cases and books, and her works installed in ways that showed the unpacking of this creation of an archive.
Mm-hmm. And that comes across, I mean, this kind of desire to kind of bring back these obscured figures, especially yeah. Black women, poets like Jeanne Duval and Gertrude Stein, as you said, and others, into the kind of Western arts canon of art history.
Exactly.
And that makes it very, very rich, and with dialogue, so kind of between the past and the present. And how did you create an exhibition like this that requires a background knowledge about, you know, who is Gertrude Stein and who is Jeanne Duval? And how did you make your audience aware or give them access to all this rich background mm-hmm. of kind of intertext, interrelated dialogues?
That was one of the biggest challenges with the mm-hmm. exhibition, in that Erica's work is so research-based, but also very conceptual. And so the stories are not always forthcoming when you see the work. It requires a lot of kind of participation on the part of the viewer, but also contextualization on the part of the curator. So I had never written such long extended labels in my life. There was a lot of text included in that show. Mm-hmm. And our whole team, we kept going back and forth. Do we let the work speak for itself and let people interpret? Or do we contextualize and do we unpack some of the stories? And in the end, we decided that not everyone who visits even knows how to look at art. Mm-hmm. It's a process. And I felt that it was a disservice to the visitor to not share that information. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time writing about the characters embedded within each work to continue to develop that archive and tell those stories.
Mm, yeah, I remember reading those. I mean, even though I knew about the name Jacques Duvivier, but I had forgotten, you know. I mean, you learn about him in the context of Baudelaire and as the muse, and then, well, forget about her. Even her name is forgotten because, you know, he's in the shadow of the male figure. So in trying to uncover, I mean, there's this fascinating story behind Jeanne Duval, her relationship, you know, her representation in art or non-representation. So literally, Diefried kind of uncovers. Could you tell us a little bit about that story? Yes.
Yeah, it is such a fascinating work and one of my favorite works in the show. Mm-hmm. And because it was such a pleasure to see people unpack just the audacity of her erasure in history. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, her until now claim to fame in history is that Baudelaire, who was this famous poet, had Jeanne Duval as a companion for many years. That's what she was known for. However, she was an actress. Mm-hmm. She was a performer. She was an artist in her own right. But because she was an exotic woman of mixed race, French and Black heritage, she was used by many as a muse. Mm-hmm. So Manet painted a painting of her. Nadar, famous photographer, took photos of her. In both works, she's unidentified. Mm. No name, no identity. Even her lover, Baudelaire, the way he describes her in his poetry is one of exoticism. Mm. He describes the texture of her hair and the smell of her hair and how it arouses him and how he desires her with nothing on but her jewelry. And so she is the inspiration for some of the most influential cultural productions of the time that she was living in, and despite that, unrecognized. Mm-hmm. And so this erasure became glaringly apparent in Gustave Courbet's painting, L'Atelier du Painter. It's a 19th century painting of Courbet in his studio. He's creating this large masterpiece, and he is surrounded by a huge crowd of different characters from kind of the French society at the time. And during this time, France was going through a huge cultural shift and industrial revolution. There was a lot of music and poetry and painting being produced. And one of the characters depicted in Courbet's studio is Baudelaire. And Baudelaire and Courbet had a very close relationship. And if you look closely in that painting, there's a figure that has been covered up that's next to Baudelaire. That was Jeanne Duval. But she was erased from the painting. And what happened was, people say that Jeanne and Baudelaire had a falling out and an argument. And Baudelaire went back to Courbet and said, erase her from the painting. I don't want her in that painting. And so she was erased. And the painting went on to show, and it became canonized in the art historical canon. After that, Baudelaire and Jeanne Duval got back together and patched things up, but she was permanently erased. It had already been shown, and she was removed from that account. And so Erica is haunted by this idea of the erasure and sees so much of herself as a mixed-race artist, and seeing Jeanne Duval, a mixed-race woman, someone who looked like her in history that had been erased, really, really haunted her. And so she started to go down this path to research Jean Duval and discovered that there's another mixed race artist, Maud Salter, who had a similar instinct about Jean Duval and had created so much work to revive her and to reshift mm-hmm. our idea of who Jean Duval was. Mm. And so we have this trifecta of characters in this body of work. We have Maud Salter, we have Jean Duval, and we have Erica de Freitas, three mixed race women who, both Maud and Erica, trying to unpack who Jean is and reinstate her in the historical mm-hmm. record. And Maud, who died in 2008, had produced this line of work that Erica highlights. And this body of work is a series of four diptychs. Each one is a process in where Erica unpacks the way that Jean is represented. So one series is looking at Maud's work. One series is looking at Baudelaire's work. One series is uncovering Gustave Courbet's painting and highlighting where she's erased from. Mm-hmm. And the final series, she goes to France and goes to the apartment that Baudelaire reportedly buys for her and picks up the rocks and stones around the building and goes to try to connect with Jean mm-hmm. to say, I see you, I know you are here, and I'm here trying to figure out my path and connect with you. Mm-hmm. So it's really, truly an incredible mm-hmm. body of investigative, intuitive, yes. research-based, and radical work that really tries to reinsert a record that had been erased from history.
Yeah, it's very moving as well, yeah. So it's like a series of collages, isn't it? Like
yes.
And we see her hands as well, trying to reconstruct these figures. So it's a very relational process of engaging with different people. And we see that also when you curated this exhibition, there was also another one that came after called The Yet.
Yes.
The Yet, which is also relational in the sense that it's about artists that de Freitas had mentored. So I found that very interesting as well, that it's like a continuation of the process of engaging with artists who had lived before her but also with contemporary artists. Mm-hmm. So I think there were like three artists that she mentored and who used photography and digital media to explore also the same theme of creating archives and narratives right. for people who had been marginalized or erased from history and art. Could you tell us a little bit about this, the significance of curating art that is about mentoring other artists?
Absolutely. So that's also a big part of what we do at the gallery, is that we celebrate the artists that come from our community, but we devote much of our resources to helping support and build up artists that are emerging out of it. And mm-hmm. Erica, having a background in education and being such a generous artist, in the process of building the show, she said, this is a big deal. Like, this is my homecoming exhibition. Mm-hmm. I want to share space. And I want to work with others who I feel can really have a voice. And so we developed this mentorship within the process. And we did a call out to emerging Scarborough artists to produce a body of work. And in the process of producing that body of work, they would be mentored by Erica and myself. And that work would be shown in an exhibition on campus in the Instructional Center, which is one of the busiest buildings in the campus. And it would be a way to honor and celebrate the work produced by these emerging artists. So we picked three who happen to be female artists. It's really interesting the way these things work out. Destiny Adulakun, Alicia Reed, and Mayuri Srikugan, all from Scarborough. And all, somehow, the themes just like aligned, all looking at their own histories and their own cultures and unpacking their own paths and how mm-hmm. they navigate the world based on where they came from. They all ended up being photography-based artists, and it aligned really well with so much of Erica's work, because so much of her work is mm-hmm. photography-based. And we ended up having this exhibition that celebrated female lineage, that celebrated female empowerment, that celebrated culture and music. And even just talking about it, I think reflecting how interesting it all kind of totally aligned with mm-hmm. Erica's practice, and that wasn't even intentional. It just mm-hmm. worked out that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a nice continuation of the exhibition in another space.
Exactly.
And that takes me to the second exhibition, which is the one that is just started. Like, it's been on for a week. And also it has a long title. So it's called A Rose Gives Its Fragrance Even to the Hand That Crushes It.
So I'm realizing all my titles are so long.
But this is also an interesting title. Yeah. Which is interesting because you go to the exhibition and you think about the title as you're looking at the exhibit, trying to make sense of it. So could you tell us about it a little bit, the background? Yeah. And
so this is also a Scarborough-based project. It's led by a collective called the Wardward Collective. The word Ward in Arabic means rose, means flower, mm-hmm. and ward is like district. And the collective is comprised of artist Petrina Ning, culture worker Patricia Rataka, educator Laura Rataka, and three members from the Syrian newcomer community, Hanan Nana, Shrouk El-Sakani, and Abd al-Ma'moum. Abd was a florist back home in Syria, and he was a very successful, well-known florist, and his career was flourishing, and then the civil war happened, and they had to flee the country as refugees. And so they came to Canada in 2017, and Abd faced various barriers to having meaningful work. And so there was huge loss of land, loss of home, mm-hmm. an attempt to find community in this new country, but also a huge loss of so much of what Abd's identity was in taking pride in his practice as a mm-hmm. florist. And so Patricia and Laura's family had sponsored them and connected with the family and really wanted to create kind of an experimental social practice collective that would see if they could create within the art community meaningful work experiences and opportunities for the family. And so the Ward Work Collective was born. And what they do is they build community gardens. They hold bouquet-making workshops. They create art installations. And their practice is a way to create meaningful work opportunities for Abd and the family, but also experiment on what are alternatives that we can do in order to bridge some of the shortcomings that come when you immigrate mm-hmm. and come to a new place and lose so much. And so the Nana family that lives in Scarborough and planted roots in Scarborough, I was really moved by their story of settling in Scarborough because Scarborough is such a magnet for immigrants. My family immigrated and lived in Scarborough. I grew up in Scarborough, and it's a place where people from many elsewheres come from, and they plant roots and they create a life. And it's thinking about Erica Show, who's also from Scarborough, originally from the Caribbean, and thinking about the Ward Word Show and thinking about the Nanas who also live in Scarborough, come from Syria. They're both within the same vicinity, but vastly different experiences. And that's something that we want to highlight. The beauty of being in this place is that you are in the same place, but you have such a vastly different experiences and perspectives and stories. And so we started this collaboration with Ward Ward 2 years ago. The campus has a campus farm, and we have a rooftop garden on the instructional center rooftop. And so we invited the Ward Ward Collective to plant damask roses in the farm and on the rooftop. Mm. And the damask rose originates in Syria. It is one of the most potent roses. It's often used as a culinary ingredient in Middle Eastern cuisine. And the initial intention of the project was to create something that would memorialize or reminisce the many lost gardens that were lost in Syria because of the war. And so while we planted these roses, we worked towards creating an exhibition. And the premise of the exhibition would be wanting to create some evocative memory of what the Nana's house was like. So today, 2 years later, you walk into the gallery And on the right, you have an installation that is evocative of a courtyard. Mm-hmm. And to the left, you have a living room and dining room. And it is the layout of their original home.
Mm-hmm.
They collaborated with a number of artists, and Campbell, Nicholas Fleming, Reza Mick, Darren Regal, Elizo Zarlatuna, all of which they have architects, artists who focus on land, photographers, ceramists, and they have all collaborated with the collective to both memorialize, record, celebrate, and develop an essence of what their home would have looked like or could have looked like. And we transplanted the roses from the farm and put them in the gallery. And they were sleeping. It's wintertime. It's very cold. Mm-hmm. And the exhibition in itself becomes an experimental process in which we are caring for the roses. We water them every day. We put them under grow lights. We're monitoring them. And we want to see if they will grow, if we will get roses in the wintertime mm-hmm. that bloom in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And so the whole project becomes kind of an experiment in metaphors mm-hmm. of care and a process of seeing if our collective acts of care could be successful in getting the roses to revive mm-hmm. despite all the conditions against it.
Yeah, and I did see some birds.
Yes, oh, you should see it now. It's okay. Incredible. It's almost all green. Okay. I can't believe how much they're thriving. It's really amazing.
Oh. And that's a very complex process from the seeds, which were shipped from Syria to the farm on the rooftop and back into the art gallery. So the art gallery becomes a space of experiment with live plants.
Yeah.
I mean, from a visitor's point of view, I thought it was very interesting to walk into the gallery, which is like a house, as you said, and it's set up like a house. And so as you stepped in, you were greeted with the scent of roses and the food. What do you think visitors get from this immersion into real space?
Mm-hmm. Someone made a comment to me. They said they visited the gallery and they saw people sitting around and just like talking. And that was one of the biggest compliments that anyone could say about the show, is that meeting with the nanas and getting to know the family, and the tradition of hospitality and welcoming is such a big part of who they are. And we wanted to create a gallery space that was as inviting and welcoming for people to spend time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a different, an immersive kind of sensational process in that you could smell the roses. Elise has a scent installation in the gallery. You could hear the sound of water. There's a fountain. You can sit down and reflect. The courtyard has this large structure that takes over the space, and it's got seating and the flowers. Even the table in the other room is open for people to sit. So people, we invite people to take meetings there and enjoy the space. We have a lounge with proper seating and books for people to read about gardens and war gardens and the history. Someone came up to me today and they're like, there's nothing on the walls. I've never seen an exhibition like this.
Yeah, there's a ceramics and on the
table. Yeah. It is made to not, I didn't want it to feel like an art gallery because it's supposed to feel more like a home or reminisce on the idea of what it's like to be in a garden or somewhere else. So I didn't want it to look like a museum and I didn't want it to feel pretentious. I wanted it to feel welcoming.
That's interesting. At the same time, it's art. So it is also a space that makes you reflect. And
exactly.
One thing I felt very strongly is like the sense of peacefulness and homeliness is also interrupted by the darker theme of war. And there's that curtain at the end, which is delicate, semi-transparent white silk curtain at the end of the patio with crushed red petals. I mean, that's what the title, I guess, comes from, the rose that gives its fragrance even to the hand that crushes it. And with petals, red petals lying crushed on the floor. And I think there's a black rose or something on the floor. And of course, behind this is another house, probably the one that's from the past, the one that belongs to the memory of the war that has probably been destroyed by war. So that was a very emotional experience to see the curtain. I think a lot of people were looking at it for a long time. How did the exhibition help the visitors navigate between these opposite kind of extreme emotions of peaceful meditation versus the pain and fragmentation of this other reality there?
Yeah, there is a bit of tension in the show because you reflect on something that's gone and something that's lost. And even the central structure in the middle of the gallery with all its seating and its water feature and the flowers is separated. It's interrupted by this gap that there's a missing piece. And Alize, who created the curtain, used patterns of river flows and migration flows in the crushed roses that imprinted the silk screen. And that image in the back behind it that's kind of blurred and almost made slightly opaque from the silk curtain is of a clothesline that once hung in the Nana's courtyard. And when we took the Nana's through the show, Abd was so moved by that piece, and he pointed out that there are green leaves hanging down from the wall, and he said that was, those were the olives, and he said we had such an abundant amount of olives and such an abundant amount of fruit. He said our soil was red from how rich it was, and we lived in such abundance and beauty. And he would talk about with such passion that life that he misses so much and reminisce on it. And so it was really beautiful to see them reflect and go back to that time. But also the exhibition is not, it's not a full garden. It's got a, the central structure is made of wood and just the top part of it is tiled. It's broken up. In the beginning of the show, the rose plants that were brought in from the farm, because it's winter time, we're thorny and bare because we're trying to wake them and they're not, it's not in their climate to come out minus 16 degrees, but it's shifting. It's really interesting to watch that shift over time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like there's an element of risk taking in it, you know, like it's not like an exhibition when you put things and you know they're going to remain the same on the walls. It's not going to, there's an element of open-endedness and a work in progress. So what are some of the excitements maybe and uncertainties and challenges you think of creating such an experimental project?
Yeah, it definitely pushed me as a curator. I'm not used to not knowing so much. And also from a logistical purpose, I work with a team. It was a challenge to try to plan for and coordinate and figure things out for something that you're really uncertain about or you're not sure what it's going to look like. And it really came down to the day before the exhibition that everything was up. And it was a real test of faith in the process of letting things evolve as they come, but also letting things go, just like just saying that this exhibition is an experiment and we will see, we'll find out together if the roses will bloom. It was a process. And also thinking about this process was also slowed down by everything that's happening in the world and artists being so sensitive to understanding that this family comes from the Middle East and there's so much conflict in that region right now. And they were also processing their own grief and their own feelings about everything that's happening. And so it was both a beautiful, poetic, but also heavy, laborious process.
Yeah. And I think that's a difficulty about art is to engage with this intensity and without making it too beautiful or too simplistic. Yeah. I think it's interesting how you brought issues, ethical issues about care, about hospitality, about the things that get eroded in war and conflict and dispossession of land and violation of human lives. So it's interesting that the care that went into nurturing the roses and also the care that went into working together on that project. So can you tell us about the significance of care, you know, like that, that the whole notion of care, which is now, you know, as it relates to art.
Yeah, it's that notion, especially in this project, unraveled itself in so many different ways. On one hand, we were responsible for the care of the roses in the farm and the instructional center rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
And so that required continuous visits and watering and fertilizing, mm-hmm. and the laborious process of care.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's a process in which the collective has this incredible relationship with the family. They work together in creating these bouquet workshops geared towards newcomers and extending care into other community members. But also the nanas, who have shown such tremendous generosity and care throughout the process, meeting with them. And as part of our continuous meetings, the nanas would invite us to their house. And even though they are recent immigrants and people who are still starting out, they would have a feast ready for us to eat until we couldn't breathe. And the notion of hospitality and care is so, mm-hmm. embedded in their ethos, which is incredible. And it's been an inspiration throughout the show, is, mm-hmm. to think about care on multi-levels. We care for land, we care, mm-hmm. for people, we care, mm-hmm. for community. Mm-hmm. And how do we emulate that in an exhibition that I hope would inspire others to care and see the humanity,
yeah.
in those who try to seek refuge and need,
absolutely.
Are in desperate need of care.
Yeah, yeah, so much needed in this world,
exactly.
at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So especially in the Middle East, as you're pointing out. Yes. Yeah, so how art can bring all these important questions into the conversation. And one thing I noticed as we're leaving the exhibition, the house, the outside the space, the gallery space, there was some bouquets, mm-hmm. located in the between. So a little bit like the first exhibition, there was like another space outside the gallery that was also a continuation of the space. So a continuation in space and time of the experience inside the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested how using those two spaces, inside and outside, you know, you talked about access and trying to break down barriers, you know, between people and art and building bridges. So could you tell us about the flowers in the vitrines and what process do they reveal, you know, mm-hmm. that's different from what's going on inside the gallery?
Yeah, that's a really beautiful question. Thank you for asking that.
Mm-hmm.
Time is a big element in the exhibition,
mm-hmm.
because time is the thing that will reveal to us if our efforts are successful,
mm-hmm.
in waking the roses.
Mm-hmm.
The architect that designed the central structure of our courtyard, Reza Nik, is of Persian background and did a lot of research on the Islamic garden and what that structure was like. And so his structure is designed based on his research.
Mm-hmm.
And the element of time is a big, long-standing element in Islamic garden, in that the continuous acts of care for the plants avoids the process of decay. And so this process of renewal, of cyclical renewal throughout the seasons, and the care of it is something that emulates eternity, similar to paradise. And so there's the process of the idea of care creating longevity. And then a few days prior, so that's one hint, like thinking about time and longevity and care and something that you can create everlasting. But on the flip side, a few days before the exhibition opened, Ward held a newcomer bouquet making workshop. And so a group of newcomers signed up for the workshop, and it was led by Abd, and they created these beautiful bouquets.
Mm-hmm.
And those bouquets are displayed in the vitrines outside the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But the only difference is those bouquets are not watered. They're taken out of their, mm-hmm. soil. They were plucked out at peak bloom and are now left to decay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tension of time, of to allow something to just not care for it and allow it to die, that vitrine will change, mm-hmm. over time throughout the duration of the exhibition as the roses dry out and die.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about what happens when there's a lack of care, but also thinking about plants and flowers from a decolonial perspective.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, the roses in the gallery are still in their soil,
mm-hmm.
and they are still in their kind of roots to be able to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, the bouquets that were purchased for the workshop,
mm-hmm.
were plucked out of their roots and bought and created these bouquets, which is such a commodified element of plants. And especially when you think of the rose,
mm-hmm.
it has become such a prominent figure of romance and Valentine's and all of the ways that you can spend money to buy bouquets of roses. But traditionally, and in the traditions that precede that commodification of the rose, it is a plant that's grown in its natural environment that is used to create scents and oils and dishes and food and things for loved ones. And there's a huge contrast between the commercialization of the plant and the traditional use.
Well, thank you for this rich background, you know, that, about, you know, everything that surrounded those two exhibitions. And do you have any project for exhibitions or different ones, you know, in the future?
Yeah, so I will be away from the gallery for a year. So my mission, and this is something that I do often, is to share space with other curatorial voices. So the next exhibition will be, it's our 20th anniversary in 2024. Okay.
All right.
And so the gallery is celebrating 20 years of being in our space. And because we're the Doris McCarthy Gallery, and Doris McCarthy is such a prolific artist from Scarborough, we're holding a huge retrospective of Doris McCarthy's work that will be guest curated.
Mm-hmm.
And the exhibition after that will be curated by another guest curator, Wanda Nanabush, an Indigenous curator who's curating an exhibition of works by Theo Kahand, who's also an Indigenous artist that asks questions about gender and identity and really kind of unpacks their own identity and process. And then after that, we have an exhibition of works by Rajni Pereira, who's also a highly celebrated Scarborough artist, incredible painting and sculptural practice. And a huge homecoming exhibition for Rajni that's a traveling show that's organized by the McMichael. I will be back after that. And I'll be working on an exhibition with also a Scarborough-based artist named Echo Namako.
Okay.
And Echo has an incredible sculptural practice made out of Legos.
Oh.
And he uses all black Legos. He's originally from Ghana, came to Scarborough, and creates these incredible sculptures that look at black futurism, what life would be like if Africa wasn't colonized and became this huge. He creates these incredibly sophisticated and magnificent landscapes and figures of children who have superpowers and almost like a futuristic, imaginative sculptures that really open space for possibility. And his practice is incredibly rich. So looking forward to coming back and working with him on that.
Yeah, well, these are exciting projects, I think. And thank you for sharing all this information and thoughts and ideas and, you know, background. Very interesting. Thank you so much, Sandy, for doing this podcast.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Uncovered. To find out more about the works discussed and the Centre for Visual Cultures, you can find links in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions about what we discussed, you can email us at centreforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk. You can also follow us on X and Instagram, both at @rhul_CBC. The episode was hosted by Anissa Talahite-Moodley. It was edited by Gareth Hughes, the music is by Gaspar Senna, and it was produced by the Centre for Visual Cultures. See you next time.